please listen carefully.
Hello, world, and welcome to the Optimist Daily Update. I'm Christy Jansen.
And I'm Amelia Buckley.
We're part of the team behind the Optimist Daily, making solutions the news. We bring you reader-funded solutions news every day in order to change the tenor of news media and the direction of your day to one focus on solutions. And today, we're doing a very special edition of the Optimist Daily Update, featuring a longer form interview that I did with a friend of mine, Akilah Shirelles, who is a community activist, peace advocate, mediator, and spirit-centered activist and campaigner against gang violence and racial injustice all over this country. Akilah grew up amongst gangs in Watts, California, and also has done really interesting, amazing things. Most recently, he's been working in Newark, but he's been a part of many inspiring projects, including the Forgiveness Project, Justice Beginnings Collaborative, the Reverence Project, Californians for Safety and Justice, Crime Survivors for Safety and Justice, and the Social Transformation Project, among other amazing things. We are very excited to share this interview with you today.
I'm excited to hear it. Let's give it a listen.
Hi, Akilah. Wonderful to see you. I love you. I'm so happy to be back in touch.
Yes. So wonderful to see you, Christy. You know, just love you. So appreciate, you know, our relationship over the years and how it's just deepened and grown. And happy to be having this conversation with you this morning.
First of all, will you do like a 2-minute who you are, where you came from, and why you think I might be talking to you today?
Okay. My name is Akilah Shirelles. I am a spirit-centered activist, organizer, advocate. I grew up in Watts, California, in the Jordan Housing Projects there. Me and my brother and a group of friends in 1992 was instrumental in organizing a peace treaty between the Crips and Bloods that changed the quality of life in our community and dominoed, you know, to multiple cities across the country, resulting in a decrease in violence and juvenile violence nationally. I co-founded an organization with Hall of Fame football great Jim Brown called AmeriCan, which essentially exported our work to some 15 cities across the country. And this was before the advent of social media. And then I lived on the road for many years doing that work. I am a serial entrepreneur as well in terms of doing like business development. I look at business and kind of organizations very similar. So I do a lot of like kind of OD and strategic planning and fund development and systems design and re-engineering.
I know you were really involved in trying to get Watts into a new era through business development in the community. I thought that was such an innovative, productive use of capital.
You know, in addition to that, you know, I end up about 6 years ago now, I opened up a restaurant, a healthy fast food chain with Chef Roy Choi, who's a celebrity chef called Local. And it was a great conceptual idea. We had 10,000 customers on our first day. We employed 40 people, paid them, you know, all livable wages. And then 3 years into the business, we ran out of money because of some bad decisions that were made by one of our partners. But there's now a Local 2.0 Chubox that is operating out of the business, providing food to local schools. We have Three Worlds Cafe in Watts. We have the Ambassador Store. Both of those businesses actually kind of grew out of the local development. And then I've been advising and consulting with Prime Store, which is one of the largest commercial developers in Southern Cal, on their rebuilding of Jordan. So, you know, Jordan Housing Projects is being torn down. It's the first development in Watts since 1947 that's been raised. And so they're expanding it from 700 low-income housing units to 1,400 units. 700 low-income, another 700 mixed rate, 200 to 300 market rate. And then Prime Store has built a 160,000 square foot retail space. So it's up and running now, actually.
That's amazing. So it's a mixed use development that brings residential and retail together.
Yep. I was consulting with local businesses to kind of prep them and prepare them to go into the new development. It's extremely challenging work. It's not my core competency.
I love getting all the broader background. But I know you've been really, really active lately in restorative justice. And yeah. I don't know if you feel like sharing a little bit of how you got into that particular model. Your personal story is really an interesting one, painful, but also inspirational.
So, you know, as I said, I grew up in the Jordan Housing Projects in Watts, and I participated in what many social justice activists call the longest running war in the history of this country, which is urban street gang wars. In LA County alone, city and county, between 1983 and 2003, there were over 30,000 gang-related deaths. And it didn't include those who've been permanently maimed or incarcerated for the rest of their life behind their participation. Now, the thing is that most of those conflicts that happened had nothing to do with gangs. But, you know, we live in a system that utilizes labels as a way of scapegoating people and making them responsible, blaming the victim, literally, because gangs aren't inherently negative. Less than 3 to 5% of so-called gang members are actually committing violent crime and murder. So the label in itself, gang, was meant to dehumanize the person behind it and to desensitize the public to the plight that people were crying out for help in their own way and they didn't speak the common language of the system. For example, the first 3 stories on most news channels is some violent story, you know, to keep people connected. Right. And so the news can say, you know, on Central and 103rd, 3 14-year-old boys were shot and killed and people will be like, oh my God, those babies. But that same news story can say on 103rd and Central, 3 gang members were shot and killed and people will be like, yeah, they deserve it. They need to go to jail. They're discouraged to society. It'd be the same 14-year-old kids. You know what I'm saying? But that label in itself can actually shift people's perception because people have an inbred idea about what gangs are, which is just absolutely just untrue. And so my work for almost 30 years now has been about, one, shifting those type of perceptions, but also building what we call community-based public safety initiatives. Right? When we organized the peace treaty in Watts, in the first 2 years, gang homicides dropped 44%. Mm-hmm. And we realized that we're the solutions to our own problems. It's impacted people who engage the public safety process that has the greatest ability to be able to reduce violence and crime. And so as a result of our work, as a direct result of our work, the city adopted our strategy. They created this program called a high-risk intervention program. But today it's called GRID. It's called the Gang Reduction Youth Development Program. And GRID has now recorded 10 consecutive years on how community-based intervention has been responsible for saving the city $100 million and preventing some like 58 murders, right, in the city.
So investing in the pro-social aspects of community building, it's a much better investment than adding more cops or adding more incarceration. The punitive justice system is actually far more expensive and destructive than a community-based restorative type of system where you're actually investing in the people. Because these are people. And that's the reason that these conflicts are erupting isn't about being bad guys or good guys or ingrate incorrigibles. Right, these are human beings who are dealing with real socioeconomic issues, dealing with family breakdown. I know there's a lot. You and I have worked together in the psychological aspects of that and the emotional healing that has to happen. And the emotional growth that has to happen for people to get to a healthier human place.
Absolutely. It's the sexual, physical, and psychological abuse that people suffer.
Right.
And so the thing is that this trauma has been allowed to fester, you know, without any type of real investment in people's healing journey, right? Yeah. And so a few years ago, about 7, 8 years ago, I was instrumental in helping to launch this organization called Californians for Safety and Justice, Crime Survivors for Safety and Justice. And these are self-identified victims who don't necessarily consider themselves there's always been a strong like victims' rights movement in the country, and especially in the state of California. However, the victims' rights movement is comprised of upper middle class white women who are primarily victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. And unfortunately, their voices have been co-opted by the law enforcement lobby, which is one of the most powerful lobbies in the country. And they've been used to pass like draconian laws, like 3 strikes and you're out, and trying our children, you know, 14 years old as adults and saying that, oh, if you do an adult crime, you do an adult time. This is absolutely ridiculous. These are children and they're redeemable. 10 years later, they're just not the same people. And the science actually proves it, right? So we empathize with them because some of them also have been victims of heinous acts. But even though Black folks are only 8% of the population in the state of California, we lead in every single category of victims of crime. But in our community, we don't see ourselves as victims, right? Because victim has a negative connotation in our community. It means that you're weak. And so we flip that term on its head and we call ourselves survivors. Because survivors speaks to a person who has had an experience, who conceivably doesn't want it to happen with anybody else, and they're engaged in their respective healing journey.
You're connecting with your resilience as opposed to the weakness, but rather the strength that comes out of that experience and the character that emerges when you overcome obstacles.
Yes, that's right. We built a movement in the state that was instrumental in changing 2 laws, and we did them as referendum, but we passed 2 of the most progressive pieces of criminal justice reform legislation in the history of the country. Prop 47, which took 6 low-level felonies and turned them into misdemeanors. Mm-hmm. 55 people who shouldn't have been in jail in the first place were released from jail immediately. because these individuals had substance abuse issues, and we were addressing those substance abuse issues with a criminal justice solution, which is just ridiculous, right?
And it's so much more expensive than putting those people into real treatment. They can the help they need, but instead incarcerating them.
And then, you know, in the state of California, if you have a felony conviction, there are over 4,800 restrictions that prevent you from accessing resources and services. And something like 73% of them are lifetime. And so to date, we've had over 300,000 people have had their records expunged. Because if you had a felony conviction for petty crime, like forgery, or, you know, you're on welfare for 2 weeks longer than you were supposed to be, you get disqualified from getting public housing, student loans, being able to access AFDC, GR, all types of things. Mm-hmm. And so we were able to move those barriers out of people's way. Some people who were suffering through these things for 30, 40 years in order to now be able to access services. Because if you are a survivor and you have some type of justice involvement, you're automatically disqualified from actually being able to receive services, healing services.
I really want to hear, why did you go to Newark? Which I know you're doing the same work now in New Jersey, and that's tremendous. And then I want to hear what you think about the moment right now. Because, I mean, the last time that this kind of unrest was really happening around the country, 2014, after Michael Brown and Tamar Rice, and that moment there, that summer in 2014, when this Black Lives Matter movement really started. But yeah. I know that the Watts riots were instrumental in you becoming the peace warrior that you've become.
Yes.
Was that period of time with Rodney King. And that also was sparked by a video of unconscionable police violence against a Black man. The history is echoing, but I'm wondering if you are sensing a movement, a change in today's moment. And I want to hear your thoughts on that, in addition to learning a little bit more about what you're doing in Newark right now.
Well, it's, you know, I would say that it's a moment that is yet to the movement, you know, but it has the potential. And so I'm in Newark, New Jersey, working for that very reason. We started this work in 1992 we started before 92, but with the Rodney King beating by LAPD, right? Because this is just a similar type of situation. But I've been knowing Grass Baraka, the mayor of Newark, for close to 25 years. And we were both activists in the community doing this work. In 2004, he invited me to Newark to help them to organize a peace treaty between two warring gangs in the city. Newark actually happens to be the home to Grape Street, which is one of the biggest Crip organizations in the city and in the state. And Grape Street is my neighborhood. That's where I grew up at. That's where I'm from, you know, in Jordan Downs. And so the mayor and his genius was like, hey, I need you to bring the brothers from L.A. to Newark so that they can see the peace treaty that you guys created there and how you guys sustained the movement. And so we brought guys here. We in turn then brought some of the brothers from Newark to LA, and we stayed in contact over all of those years. In 2014, when Baraka was elected mayor, he invited me to come to the city and to build out his community-based public safety initiative. And some people call it gang intervention, some people call it interrupters, but it's beyond that. We call it community-based public safety because it's a complementary strategy to law enforcement. So the organization that was birthed is called the Newark Community Street Team. We're the City of Newark's community-based public safety initiative. We have a three-pronged strategy that we implement in order to address violence. You know, we work through the public health lens that violence is a public health issue. Mm-hmm. And we understand that there's two parts of the city, the South Ward and the West Ward, that experience a tremendous amount of violence. And our take on it is that the reason why has been because these communities have been literally neglected since the 1967 rebellion, because Watts kicked it off in 65. In 67, you know, Newark was the second place that the rebellion happened. There has been no investment in these neighborhoods since 67. No investment in people, no investment in infrastructure. There's houses that are still burnt out from 67. And so we, you know, understand trauma, and we understand trauma-informed approaches. So we built this three-pronged strategy. One leg of it is about high-risk intervention. So we employ credible messengers from the neighborhood. These are ex-gang members, ex-convicts, ex-drug dealers, folks who know everybody and their mom in the neighborhood, right? And we train them as public safety professionals to intervene in individual and group conflicts. We also meet on a consistent basis with law enforcement. Law enforcement shares intelligence with us. There's a very high bar in terms of police being able to arrest and prosecute someone in terms of what has to be in place. And so in most cases, they can't always arrest and prosecute, and nor can they prevent shootings from happening. What we can do is work on preventing the next one, you know, the retaliation. Right. And so our people are much more uniquely positioned to be able to do that because of relationships. So we utilize a relationship-based approach to do this work. We also utilize data through our partnership with Rutgers University to inform our strategy as well. Because one of the things that we discovered in 2016 was that 62% of the homicides that happened in the city started as domestic disputes. So our belief is that if we could stand in the gap, if our folks are trained in conflict resolution and mediation and trauma-informed practices and approaches, and then also have wraparound services and legal services and support services, then we can prevent some of these things from happening. And also we can connect people to services so that they can be engaged in a respective healing journey. Our second prong, which is kind of like our forward-facing piece, is our Safe Passage Program. Through our research, we discovered that most of the violence that happens in the community happens in and around schools. Things happen on campus that spills out in the community on Friday. Things happen in the community on Saturday and Sunday that spills onto the campus on Monday morning.
Okay.
So we make sure that our kids go to school safely and come home. So every morning at all of the key exit and entries at 12 schools in the South Ward, we have a team that's out there from 7:30 to 9 and then from 2:30 to 4 in the afternoon, making sure that our kids go and come to school safely.
So, and these are trained adults who are respected in the community who can actually prevent petty disagreements from erupting into serious violence.
Really serious disagreements as well.
Okay.
Because of the trauma that exists, you know, all situations can escalate to life-threatening situations, like from 0 to 100 immediately.
Right.
And so
has that dropped those events from happening?
Absolutely. So we launched the work in 2014, right?
Mm-hmm.
In 2016, we had double-digit reductions in homicides in the city.
Tremendous.
We took Newark off the most violent city list after being there for 50 consecutive years.
Amazing.
Okay? Every year since 2016, we've had reductions in homicides and violence and overall violence in the city. Mm-hmm. In 2019, we had a 30-year low. And in the South Ward, where our work is targeted, we had a negative 48% reductions in homicides. We cut the murder rate in half in 5 years. And this is because of our strategic relationship with law enforcement, with, you know, community-based organization, with faith-based community, you know, with our health department. And so we coordinate and we host a conversation, a policy conversation, in which we hold our electeds accountable, called the Public Safety Roundtable, twice a month. So that's a part of our overall strategy,
okay,
right? Because we have to engage more people in the public safety process. For far too long, you say public safety and people say police, right? But we understand that police are only one aspect of the public safety process, mm-hmm. you know? And that public safety is not crime stats. It's not the absence of violence and crime only. It's the presence of well-being and the infrastructure to support victims and survivors in their respective healing journey.
I love that. It's the presence of well-being. Public safety is not the absence of violence. It's the presence of well-being. That's deep. That's a deep, deep statement.
Absolutely. Safety is critical in terms of this work. So our third prong is our victim services work. We have a full-time victims advocate in which we connect people with therapists, with alternative healing technologies. We help folks complete their victims of crime application. In every state, there is a victim compensation organization, and it's usually flush with money. However, because of structural violence and institutional racism, Black folks in the city of Newark were getting disqualified 90% of the time when they would apply for victim comp.
On what grounds are they disqualified?
Contributing behavior. That's what the clause is called. Right? So if you're Raheem and you're hustling, you know, you're hustling in the street, right? And say you get shot, they'll say that, hey, he was hustling, it contributed to him being murdered. That's a contributing factor that disqualifies him. And so they punish the family from receiving resources to bury
his mother up. And his sisters can't get any help, even just to deal with their own grief. They can't even get the supportive services that would normally be available to someone like me, is a upstanding member of the community. I'm a middle-aged white woman, right?
They call it, they're like pure victims, but we
exactly
smash that whole false narrative that they're pure victims, because in our community, it's not uncommon for a Black mother to have one child buried in prison and one in the graveyard, you know?
Yeah.
So this idea that there are pure victims out here is just absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
The number one preemptive cause for murder in most urban communities is self-defense, because we have a criminal justice system that is unresponsive to our needs. When we go to the police department and say, hey, Pookie man is messing with me, man. Y'all need to come and do something about this. They'd be like, where your gun at? You know? And then the other contributing piece is that when the detective shows up to the hospital and Raheem is shot laying in the bed and he's going to survive, when they fill out the police report that has to then go to the prosecutor's office to qualify them for victim comp, they put suspect victim. which automatically disqualifies them from receiving victims' compensation. And so these folks are not getting any services, rightfully so. They hate the police, not only because they brutalize them and there's excessive force issues and there's a history of abuse, but also they disconnect them from being able to receive services to support them in their respective healing journey. But we've been able to really turn that on its head in the city of Newark, and it's because of the leadership here. Mm-hmm. The mayor is the most progressive mayor in the country. I mean, this cat is brilliant. He understands the work. This is his community. He's not a regular type of politician. Mm-hmm. We're fortunate that our public safety director, Anthony Ambrose, you know, as well as Chief Darnell Henry, they both grew up in this city. They're mm-hmm. from the city. And even though one is white and one is black, they all believe in the same thing. And so seeing NCST, the Newark Community Street Team, as a complementary strategy to law enforcement, because we're going to have more intelligence than they're ever going to have. So we're like, we need you to help us to gain greater access so that we can provide services for our people. And instead of them calling you sometimes, they need to just call us.
Right. And so then creating those kind of community-based, relationship-based, supportive services as a part of the public safety, it takes some of the pressure off the policing.
Straight up.
Right?
That's right. Because you know what our cops go through? Our cops are working 4 12-hour shifts. They are totally stressed out. They experience the level of vicarious trauma and hypervigilance that they come to work with. The culture of the police department is if they even talk about, you know, having an emotional or psychological break, they get degunned and deshed.
Cultural problems of the trauma is happening on both sides of this equation.
Right.
Yeah. So how do we support our first responders who are the police in this situation and allow, destigmatize the fact that they are all dealing with PTSD?
That's right.
How do you give them the emotional and psychological support they need?
Two ways we support them. One, we invest in community-based public safety initiatives as a complement to law enforcement so that they don't have to respond to everything. You know, they don't have to respond to every loitering situation, every domestic issue. They're not built that way. We want cops to be able to respond to high-risk situations and stuff that require them to show up with that hammer on their hip. You know what I'm saying? The second way that we can support them, because
our police works for us.
That's right. Police work for us. And so one of the things that the public can do in terms of supporting our officers is that we got to make the department provide therapeutic services for our cops, be it counseling, be it therapy, be it healing technologies, you know, and we have to make it public. We got to take this whole piece around psychosocial evals that our cops do from behind the screen, and we have to bring it out and make it public. Because honestly, sometimes the unions are part of the problem. There's sometimes, I mean, of course they protect officers' jobs, they do collective bargaining agreements and everything, which sometimes is great, you know, but in terms of supporting them in their respective healing journey, I mean, these cops are involved with police-involved shootings, and then the next day they're back on the force, out in the street. Right. And that trauma hasn't been addressed. And then they tell you, oh, we set you this thing up where you can go and have cop-to-cop talk. I'm like, get out of here. No, these people need therapy because you know who are the biggest victims of law enforcement when they don't get the therapy? It's their family and their children.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And it's like anybody who has a cop in their family know this because the number one cause of death for police officers is suicide. It's suicide, number one. And so we got to make sure that our cops are getting the proper therapy and counseling and healing, you know, methodologies that they need in order to be able to serve the public properly.
It has to be done in a way that doesn't continue to stigmatize them.
That's right.
I mean, we did a story for Solutions News a few months ago about first responders and destigmatizing that kind of trauma support therapy for firefighters and for nurses. And when you're dealing with life and death situations, whether it's something that's not as tinged like saving somebody from a fire or you're watching a house burn down or you're hearing the screams of somebody you are not able to get to, that is a traumatizing event. And that is not something you can just walk away from, get up the next morning and feel like a normal person, right?
Right.
This is what's happening with the nurses now with the victims of COVID who are watching unprecedented numbers of people gasping for air. It's again, it's the breath thing, right? It's like we're suffocating ourselves in trauma. And the people who are responding to this trauma need help just as much as the victims or the survivors of the violence in these communities.
Right. Well, you know, I've always been a big advocate and supporter of Dr. Lisa's work with Women's Association. I'm fortunate that I get an opportunity to consult with multiple cities across the country in terms of community-based violence and looking at the intersection between law enforcement and communities healing. I connected, you know, Glendon with my good friend, Dr. Bronstein in South Dakota. for the work that we were doing in Rapid City, you know, with Native communities and law enforcement and that whole kind of thing, because there's high levels of suicide that happens in Native communities. And I think that there's just not enough infrastructure in those cities to be able to support folks in their healing journey.
Right. And it's the social infrastructure that's lacking.
That's right.
As much as the physical infrastructure. It's the social network infrastructure.
Physical, I would say, and both.
So we have 2 minutes before you have to get off, but I would love to get just what you think with what happened in Minneapolis.
Minneapolis is actually one of the cities that I have been working in for 3 years before the situation happened. You know, trying our best to advise leadership in the city. And, you know, they have great leadership. Chief Randall is an ally, you know, Deputy Chief Knight, my man Glenn Burke, who runs the Navigators program in the city that's connected through MPD. The thing is that the system is just so convoluted, right? And so then what happens is that our brother George Floyd is murdered, you know what I'm saying, by cops who are insensitive and who are ill-trained. And so we're at an inflection point in terms of policing in this country. We're never going to go back to the way things were. And so my belief is that, like, what's the solution? The thing that people are protesting every day out in the street for, the solution is community-based public safety. You know, some of these cops, they don't even live in the city. They live in other states, and all of this stuff is about to come out. They're parachuting in, working 3 12-hour shifts. They come in, you know, totally desensitized and discombobulated, and then they go out to their other 2 3 jobs that they're working in order to make ends meet. We have to invest in community-based public safety initiatives so that instead of the liquor store owners having to call the police when something goes awry, they can reach out and call one of their neighbors who are trained in public safety policy, you know, in conflict resolution and mediation and restorative justice and trauma-informed practices to be able to peacefully mediate these conflicts to a successful outcome. Because our cops are not always the best messengers and the most credible messengers in terms of responding to these types of things. Mm-hmm.
Especially when they're not, the cops aren't the neighbors, right? You need to have a neighbor kind of mentality, a community mentality.
That's right. And, you know, so our officers, man, like, my heart goes out to those folks, right? And at the same time, we don't need to be spending, you know, $300 million a year on a police department and then closing down youth clubs and programs and social services and libraries. It's absolutely insane that we've created this police culture that has nothing to do with safety. It's about policing. And policing and safety are two totally different things.
Thank you for listening to the Optimist Daily Update. We promise to continue to share positive, solution-based stories with ideas on how you can participate in this changing world and ensure it is changed for the good. We promise to cover the current events with accuracy, legitimate sources, and offer you the information needed most to chart new paths for all of us. Please consider becoming an emissary on theoptimistdaily.com, and for just $5 a month, support reader-funded independent journalism. Be part of the solution-changing consciousness and addressing our world's biggest challenges with a problem-solving mindset. Please join us again on Monday for our next Optimist Daily Update. Thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next week.